Imperial War Museum's Voices of the First World War.
Podcast 22. Jutland.
Where is the fleet? Where are you? What direction are you? We were sending out urgent signals, coding them, sending them out to the battlefield, and he never answered.
The Battle of Jutland on the 31st of May 1916 was the only major confrontation between British and German naval forces during the First World War. Up until then, there had been smaller clashes, German U-boat attacks, and raids on the British coast, but no full-scale battle. The moment the British and German navies were waiting for had arrived. Frederick Morris, who served in HMS Marlborough, described the atmosphere on the day of the battle.
Well, the day it happened, in the morning, there was a feeling somewhere that things were happening, because in those days we had no wireless or telephone like now. The only was ordinary wireless, ship to ship. But there was a feeling in the air somehow that there was something happening. And then in the afternoon we found out that it was actually happening. We started to prepare for going to battle then, getting everything ready, getting prepared so we knew. Then we heard, later in the afternoon, we heard firing. Then, of course, we went to action stations.
The commander of the German High Seas Fleet, Admiral Reinhard Scheer, planned to lure the British battlecruiser fleet, led by Vice Admiral Sir David Beattie, into a major fight in the North Sea. He aimed to destroy part of it before the main British Grand Fleet, under Admiral Sir John Jellicoe, could arrive to help. However, as British officer Graham Donald explained, Britain's naval intelligence forewarned the Royal Navy.
We knew there was something rather big on hand. We did discover later that the Admiralty itself, who were pretty wide awake, a lot of people, you know, they had actually been detecting a good deal of wireless activity over in the keel direction. They were able to spot the movement of the ships and realise that there was quite a large number of German ships moving in keel and evidently making for sea.
The British needed to know the size of the German force they would be facing. Gerald Livock served with the Royal Naval Air Service aboard the seaplane carrier HMS Engadine.
We were stationed in the Firth of Forth in the seaplane carrier Engadine. We used to go out with the fleet whenever they went out. And on the afternoon of Jutland, when some smoke was sighted on the horizon, we were told to send out a seaplane on reconnaissance. By some good fortune, it was calm enough for it to take off, and it did actually take off and spotted some cruisers, some German cruisers, and reported them. The Battle of Jutland then started.
Both Beattie's and Jellicoe's forces put to sea from their bases in Scotland. Despite the build-up of activity, the bugle call to action stations came as a surprise to some, such as Arthur Gaskin in HMS Malaya.
We were steaming along there, and on Wednesday is what they call a make amend day. Me and my mate Smith, we was laying on top of one of the turrets and on the forecastle edge, you know, in the sun and it. And all of a sudden it was 3:30, it was 7 bells. The marine bugler sounded all cooks of the galley. That means one man had to go and prepare the meals for them. And at the same time, the marine bugler sounded all action station at the double. And I set up quick. Then we see the line and Tiger and them in the distance. I saw a big, huge smoke come from the line. And I said to Robert, look, it looks like the line's opened fire on something. And it was the start of the Battle of Jutland.
The Germans were unaware that the full British fleet was heading towards them. As Beattie's battlecruisers scouted ahead, they found the advancing Germans. HMS Galatea fired the battle's opening shot. Torpedo artificer Alfred Leggett was a member of her crew.
We were the starboard van for Beattie. That we went, well, within visual signal distance of him on his starboard bow. And then we saw this merchantman hove to with a German destroyer boarding her, or attempting to board her. And we went up to sea, and when we got nearer this German destroyer, it was part of a flotilla, and that was part of a squadron, and that was part of the German High Sea Fleet.
Contact came in the North Sea, off Jutland, on the coast of Denmark. Beatty's battlecruisers opened fire, but the shots went long. C. Farmer was a signaller on board HMS Indefatigable, part of the 2nd Battlecruiser Squadron.
It's about 3:30 in the afternoon when we steamed towards a German fleet, 6 battlecruisers, Admiral Beatty leading. We opened fire at 14,000 yards, which was too far. Beatty made a signal close near the enemy, which we did. We closed near the enemy, and a message came through that the flags was entangled round the mast, somebody must go up. So I took my sea boots off, climbed out the foretop, went up the Jacob's ladder, right to the very top. I unfurled the flag, and I sat on the wireless yard, looking around. I could see all the German fleet, and I made out roughly 40 ships. There were 6 of us.
The 5th Battle Squadron entered the battle at around 4 p.m. Soon, both the British and German warships were scoring hits on each other. Gunnery officer J. Hazelwood served in HMS Warspite.
My station was in B turret, and with the other members of the gun's crews, we were ready and we were looking forward to a chance to have a crack at the enemy. We were keen. This was the day we were waiting for. And the officer in charge of the turret was also excited at the chance that we got. Presently, the order was given, bring the guns to the ready. The guns were brought to the ready, and we waited for the first bang. Bang went the first salvo, away to the enemy, and off we started. Working in rhythm, the shells and the cordite coming up from below, being put into the guns, and they were kept firing as quick as possible. It was just a normal routine to the men in these turrets. They'd done it so often, in practice, that things just worked.
Seriously outnumbered, Beatty turned north towards the main British fleet. Unaware that Jellicoe was heading in their direction, the Germans gave chase and met the Grand Fleet. It was now Admiral Scheer who was outnumbered. As the battle raged, Harold Wright had a chance to survey the action from his ship, HMS King George V.
Then eventually I had another message to say that, seeing that we weren't going to be actively engaged for a little time, that a limited number of hands from each department could go up on deck to watch the action. So I made my way up onto the boat deck and took up station there, and we could see the German fleet silhouetted against the setting sun. You could watch our shells hitting, and you could also see the blast of their guns firing.
Despite the intensity of the shellfire and the threat of battle all around them, the members of both navies recalled their lack of fear during the action. German officer Edgar Luchting served with the 14th Destroyer Flotilla.
It may perhaps surprise people that although it was the first event of this kind for my boat and probably for at least 90% of all people involved in this action, there was no excitement at all. The behavior of the crew was excellent. The boat went smoothly, as always, and we more or less enjoyed the whole thing as a big theater event, although it certainly was not without some danger.
Henry Fancourt was a teenage midshipman aboard HMS Princess Royal.
Well, you weren't frightened, you were excited, and they're guns crew and they all give another bang, 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 and oh no, it's a great phase, like being in a football match, you know, you watch your side to win, you know, and you think about casualties and disasters until later.
Over the course of the battle, the German gunners scored more direct hits than the British. Frederick Morris described his ship, HMS Marlborough, coming under fire.
Then we realised that we are really into it then. And of course, when you get a big salvo of the turret firing, the ship shudders like anything, you see. I don't know whether, I don't think they fired a salvo at each time, but a turret at a time, I suppose, they were firing. It's difficult to tell, really, because if they do fire a salvo, the ship actually shudders. No question about that.
The effect of other huge warships being hit nearby was clearly recalled by George Simmons of HMS St. Vincent.
Well, you couldn't actually hear. The only thing you could hear was if a ship was sunk, your ship went up and down like a jelly on the sea, open sea. because there were several ships of ours were sunk during the time, and we was more or less close quarters, to my estimation of it, that it didn't matter if it was a German boat that went up, it still vibrated in the sea. And of course then you got like the St. Vincent, you've got a 13,000 ton ship, all steel, going down in one bulk under the sea. So I mean, say, it's got to, in your close quarters in a circle, you see, you're bound to get a vibration from that ship.
The British lost several warships fairly early on, suffering from accurate German range finding. The battle cruiser HMS Queen Mary was sunk at around 4 p.m. witnessed by Arthur Crown from HMS Shannon.
I remember we could hear the firing and firing, but it was so misty, we didn't see the actual ships. But I was on deck on one occasion. I saw a terrific amount of smoke and fire that went up in the air, and when it died down, there was nothing left to be seen. And I found out, and it was announced, it was the Queen Mary. It was the most vivid impression, because when I came to think of it, after that hit, there was over 1,000 men had gone down with her. Now, she was obviously hit very, very badly. Subsequently, we were talking amongst ourselves. We reckoned that the Germans specialised using armour-piercing shells more than we did.
Exposed on the edge of the battle, HMS Chester came under withering fire. Leading stoker Bert Stevens was a member of her crew.
During that period of action, there was some gunfire on the port beam. An admiral on the Invincible told our skipper, who was in charge of Chester, to go and investigate. We goes over and investigates. We went through a mist. When we get there, we'd had our 5 Germans. Of course, there's only one thing for it. We fought the 4. We managed to get a torpedo into one of them. They smashed us up. Terrible. All the guns crews that wasn't killed, some were seriously wounded. Jackie Cornwall, VC boy, was on the forward gun, and he stood at his post. The bridge was down. Foremost funnel was nearly down. She was old all in the side.
Another loss was HMS Invincible, the flagship of the 3rd Battlecruiser Squadron. Reginald Ashley of HMS Iron Duke saw her sink.
My battle station was in the foretop. And then we were seeing these shells coming up. We couldn't see the German fleet, this range-finding business. We knew nothing about them. These shells were hitting the Invincible and the Indomitable. And I saw the Invincible go down. Oh, terrible. I don't want to see any more. She turned over with all these blokes hanging on to her. And then you could see the wakes of the torpedoes from the submarines coming towards each ship.
Over 1,000 men were drowned when the Invincible sank. Gunnery officer Hubert Danreuther was one of only a handful of survivors.
Well, she went down with a crash, and I was pushed out of her. Came up to the surface again. I was a bit out of breath, and I saw the target floating by. So I then got on it and found 2 other fellows there. And then shortly afterwards, the Badger came alongside and picked us up.
The British were hampered during the action by poor visibility, as midshipman Bonham Founce of HMS Hercules remembered.
I remember the captain, a message from the captain to the gunnery officer, which direction to point drove into gun, and he ought to be able to see some German ships soon. But the visibility was very bad by that time. It's hazy, there's a haze. And there's a lot of smoke hanging around too, which means eventually the gunnery officer and his assistant, scouting officer, I heard them say, there they are, words to that effect. And I popped my head up and vaguely saw in the mist some, obviously we had big ships, couldn't tell what they were.
The mist-filled skies were also a problem for the German fleet, including Edgar Luchtin.
The sea was calm, it was fine weather, especially in the first 1 or 2 hours. Later on it became more cloudy, and moreover the smoke of the burning ships and of the gunpowder more or less obscured the view, sometimes up to 100%. That meant that if we were only 1,000 or 2,000 meters away from our ships, we couldn't see them anymore. And in one case that led to a rather awkward accident, which might have meant disaster for us, we had made a torpedo attack on the British ships. We had broken through our ships and tried to come so near to the British line that we could fire our torpedoes. But the British line turned away, and so it was simply hopeless to try and reach a position from which we could shoot our torpedoes. And so we turned back and looked for our own ships. There were none. There were smoke, clouds, but no German ships.
The poor visibility only exacerbated what was already a confused encounter between the fleets. William Parsons, a petty officer on board HMS Munster, described the chaotic nature of the battle.
Well, you know, in a way, it almost became watching a film, if you understand what I mean. So much was going on that you didn't get time to think of yourself or anything. You'll probably see a ship being shelled over there. You say, poor devils, poor devils. At the same moment, you get a couple of bricks alongside you, you see. But before you could think about those, something else was happening over there. There was so much going on. And you not knowing the general strategy, you felt how small you were, you see. You took it quite easily. There was no fear or anything like that, you know. A moment of sympathy, perhaps. But then there was so much going on that you hadn't time to sympathise even.
Poor communication between their two main leaders, Beatty and Jellicoe, severely impaired the effectiveness of the British during the battle. William Pickett was a wireless signaller in Jellicoe's flagship, HMS Iron Duke.
In the meantime, Beatty's about 30 miles ahead and not telling us where he is and what they're doing. That was absolutely neglect, which had been in all the books, and it's common knowledge that he never told us what he should have done. And us on our side began to ask, where is the fleet? Where are you? What direction are you? We were sending out urgent signals, coding them, sending them out to the battle fleet, and he never answered.
Realising he was outnumbered, Admiral Scheer ordered his fleet to turn away. Although losing its intensity, the battle continued as night started to fall. George Wainford assessed the situation from HMS Onslaught.
After about 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, things eased up. Lots and lots of wreckage. We passed one naval raft thing full of our chaps cheering us. Well, we didn't stop to pick them up because we were doing something else, and we knew there was lots of German submarines about. And I always remember the amount of dead fish there were floating about. I think they'd been killed by concussion. When ships blew up, they were concussing. There was fish everywhere floating about on the surface.
Considerable damage had been inflicted on the British fleet. J. Hazelwood couldn't believe the state of his ship, HMS Warspite, which had come under heavy fire during the action when her steering had jammed.
I come out from the top manhole onto the top of the gun turret, and I was amazed at what I saw. Part of the bridge was alight, which consisted of a storage of lifebelts. They were all in flames. I could see that the 6-inch battery, there's a fire raging there from the cordite. The upper deck was riddled with shell. Not a bolt was fit to be put in the water. From there, I went down to the captain's cabin, and I was amazed at the shambles. I picked up at the door my captain's miniature medals as an example, which had come from a cupboard on the side. And there was also, in parts of the stern, 2 and 3 foot of water in compartments.
Unsurprisingly, there were high casualties on the British side. The loss to the crew of HMS Malaya was felt by Arthur Gaskin.
Then I realised then, you know, that death was in the air sort of thing. We lost 75 men on our ship, and we buried someone at sea on the way back to Invergordon, and my chum went. It brought home to me more when I saw them all laid out on the deck. You know, I thought, oh dear, oh dear. And it was an experience I never want to have again, you know, sort of thing.
As night fell, the battle disintegrated into a series of small but fierce engagements that lasted through the early hours of the 1st of June. but the British were reluctant to engage in serious night fighting. As Officer John Overy explained, and in the darkness, the German fleet managed to escape.
Ever so often, we, in the dusk, a ship came into view, and twice we opened fire, and whom it was fired back at us. I think it was German battle cruisers, but with no result. But it was very unpleasant, because in half light, you see the flashes at point-blank range almost, then wait for something to happen. And then, of course, both sides turned away, because in darkness, it's too much of a gamble to go into action at night. You never know quite what's going to happen. So it's best to avoid action at night at any time. And that was the policy of the British ships. Never go into action at night, because you might sight a ship point-blank range, and if they get their lights on first, get their broadside in first, you'll probably go. So night action was never advocated by the British, that I did know.
The Battle of Jutland ended in no apparent victory for either side. Both fleets had suffered losses, but neither had been completely destroyed. Alfred Leggett summed up the disappointment felt by the British after this much-anticipated naval encounter.
But it was a lamentable business because it wasn't a victory. We lost as many ships and more men than the Germans did. It's true that the German High Sea Fleet never came out again as such, but it wasn't a victory in the sense that Trafalgar was a victory, or Matapan was a victory in latter days. I don't think.
However, Arthur Crown was more philosophical about the result. He rightly pointed out that the Germans never again seriously challenged the Grand Fleet's control of the North Sea.
And I realise, as an old regular serving Navy man, the fact people used to talk about, well, we didn't do well. The proof is they never came out again. They never came to risk of getting them again. Although we were used many times to go up not far off that coastline hoping to draw them out. And the Grand Fleet would never be far away. Perhaps wouldn't be close enough to save us, but the mice didn't come after the bit of cheese. And so that's how we survived the Battle of Jutland.
Jutland was a strategic victory for Britain and the Royal Navy. But for Reginald Ashley, the key aspect of the battle was not who had won, but who had been lost.
But what impressed me was going back to Scarpa Flow, when we got to the scene where the battle started. The fleet either slowed down or stopped, and we had a memorial service for every man that was lost in that battle. And it was the most impressive scene that fixes in my mind, always will. I don't want to go through that again.
Find out more about the First World War at iwm.org.uk. We'd really like to know what you think of these podcasts. Please rate us or leave a comment on iTunes. Listen out for podcast 23, the first day of the Somme.